You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 21 of ADHD BCE. In this special episode, we're once again stepping out of the ancient past and into the vivid present. This time to explore the fascinating world of synesthesia, a form of neurodivergence where the senses blend together in unexpected and magical ways. Think seeing colours when you hear music, or tasting flavours when you hear words, or feeling textures when you read numbers. It's real, it's rare, and it's utterly captivating. And what's especially exciting today is that our guest, Nicola Rose, is a writer and director whose brand new movie, Magnetosphere, centres around a young girl with synesthesia, a film that brings this sensory experience to life with emotion, beauty and insight. Honestly, I watched it with my kids the other day, and I have to say it's such a beautiful, innocent, warm representation of not just synesthesia, which we experience through the lenses of Maggie, who's a 13-year-old girl struggling with moving to a new school. But I also saw a lovely neurodivergent family and some excellent parenting, as well as a supportive teacher. It's such wonderful characters. My kids and I loved how vibrant and sensory the film was, especially the colours and sounds. It's well worth a watch. And let's be honest, Magnetosphere is a gorgeous portrayal of neurodiversity. I'll make sure the link to the movie website is in the show notes. Just for my fellow archaeology nerds out there, yes, we are taking a slight detour from our usual deep dive into ancient history, but bear with me because this connects. Research suggests synesthesia is present in 3 to 4% of the population, and some scientists believe it may be more common in early childhood, gradually fading as the brain prunes unused connections. So unlike the emerging genetic and skeletal evidence for traits like autism in Neanderthals, for example, or, I don't know, high-functioning impulsivity and pattern-seeking that may have defined ADHD in the Paleolithic, we don't yet have archaeological proof for synesthesia. But if we take our classic ADHD BCE approach and lay that neurodivergent filter across human history, it's tempting to wonder whether some early shamans, visionaries, or storytellers had synesthesia. I mean, imagine trying to explain to the tribe that thunder tastes like salt, or that your mother's name smells like cinnamon. That may have earned you mystical status or a seat at the edge of the fire pit. But either way, it's a beautiful lens through which to reimagine how humans have always experienced the world in different ways. But we will save that particular daydream for another episode, because today I am thrilled to welcome a fellow neurodivergent, a brilliant creative, Nicola Rose, writer, director and proud advocate for neurodiverse storytelling. Nicola, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, no, honestly, it's an absolute pleasure. It's so great to have you on here, Nicola. But before we get into Magnetosphere and synesthesia, I'd love to ask about you. We all have our own neuro spice mix. I'm ADHD, autistic, and probably a few other secret ingredients still pending diagnosis. Well, what's your particular blend, Nicola, and how has that shaped your creative path?
Well, we all have those ones that are hidden that just haven't yet poked their nose out to be diagnosed. But I have been diagnosed with ADHD. Yeah. And I did have synesthesia as a young child, although I don't think I have experienced it in more recent years. That's not something I'm aware of. I think those are the main two that I'm aware of. And there are probably things that just don't have names or haven't yet, as I say, been diagnosed. I think there's a lot going on for all of us neurodivergent folks that we're not necessarily so aware of.
Absolutely, yeah. I think a lot of that comes from awareness. You know, we were sort of born with it, or we learn to cope in certain ways, or to mask or whatever. And you do, you sort of go through life bundling through experiences, and you don't realise until you learn a little bit more about something, either through social media or a friend of a friend or whatever, you discover that actually that sounds a lot like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk synesthesia. You've clearly spent time immersed in this world personally and for research. For anyone listening who's never heard of it, what is synesthesia? And for those who do live with it, how does it feel for these people to experience the world through multiple senses?
Sure. So synesthesia is a perceptual or neurological phenomenon. Some might simply call it a neurodivergence, where your senses are combined or intertwined in some way so that one sensory input might produce multiple sensory outputs. Like you mentioned, for example, that the days of the week might have colors or tasting, you know, music might have a taste or sounds might have a color or some other input might have, you know, some visual input might have a texture, something like that. And the ways that people experience this are kind of all over the map because, as you can imagine, there are, you know, potential hundreds and hundreds of combinations, sensory combinations that could conceivably exist here, you know. And so some people might experience it in a heightened and wonderful way that's very positive. Other people might experience it as something troublesome or annoying, or it might even become ugly and jarring and painful, which is something that is discussed, also touched on, I should say, in the movie. All of those different possibilities are. And in doing research for the movie, I spoke to, at one point, obviously I could not use anywhere near this many experiences, but I must have spoken to 70 different people who had synesthesia of different kinds, different modalities. And hearing their stories, they were all very vivid. They were all very different. And I don't think there were any two people who experienced their world in the same or even similar ways. I don't think there were two people who would have agreed on how synesthesia actually works, which is part of what makes it such a fascinating sort of little enigma to me. And it was something that I really wanted to keep studying up on and writing about. And at that time, I didn't realize I had ever experienced it. That took a while for me to put two and two together.
Oh, I see. So it was through research for the movie that you recognized it in your childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, doesn't it just show the depth of neurodiversity? Because we always say, you know, what percentage of the population are neurodiverse? And then you get different stats on that, you know, 25%, 15%, 10%, 5%, depending on your particular spice mix, as we've just mentioned. You know, even just ADHD on its own, people who just have that can be completely different from person to person. There's no two autistics are the same, even though, you know, dinosaurs and stones and things like that are genuinely really interesting. But the experience and what you have, it is different for all of us. So that whatever percentage of the world that is neurodiverse or neurodivergent, all of us are completely different as well. We're not all just that unruly ADHD kid or that hyper-focused autistic kid. You know, there's so much more going on.
No, it might manifest so many different ways. And I've heard it estimated, you bring up percentages, which is a good point, because I've heard it estimated on good authority that probably 4% of the population have this. And I am not good authority. And I have no idea why I'm saying this, but I think it's just got to be so much more because so many people would never know they have it. So many people, we can't know that our neighbor has it. We can't know that our own selves have it. We probably all begin with it in some way. So, you know, there's no way that's not an underreport.
Yeah, I always get confused with these stats because I think here in the UK, I can't remember what, I'm rubbish with numbers. I've got dyscalculia, so I can, do you say it's either dyscalculia or dyscalculia?
I've heard it both ways too.
Yeah, good. It's not just me. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so, oh God, I've done that thing where I forgot where I was going. I do this in so many episodes.
Having to do with the percentages of different people.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, numbers and percentages. So in the UK, whatever percentage was, it was like, and I read it several times, I think it was like 11% or something like that. I'm probably wrong there. But then they said out of those 11%, only a small portion of those are diagnosed. So it's not people who have been diagnosed that in that stat. This is the trouble with stats, isn't it? And so, I think as well, if people aren't fully aware of it, I mean, if you had synesthesia that you can remember, but it wasn't, you couldn't remember until it was triggered through your research, how many other people maybe even would watch Magnetosphere, because as I watched it, I got quite emotional a number of times in that.
Well, thank you for saying.
Oh, it's beautiful. And the way the colours bounce and come and the sounds go, I don't know. I mean, I've never experienced anything like that I can remember, but it didn't seem completely alien. It seemed kind of like, yes, magical in some ways, but also like it should be normal. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does somehow. I'm not sure why, but yes.
We're meeting somewhere in the middle. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, neither of us are able to talk definitively about synesthesia, although, of course, you're way more qualified than I am. But I would love to just jump now onto how you got into filmmaking. Was storytelling part of your neurodivergent brain's way of making sense of the world?
I think you've hit on it. I think that's exactly what happened. I think that was the only way I had of making sense of people and things that just otherwise were completely confusing to me as a child. And filmmaking specifically didn't pop up until much later. I don't think that's a typical thing for a young child to get into. But yeah, for me, it was much later. I was in my late 20s when I actually made my first film project, which was like a tiny web series made on all of $2,000 for the whole entire thing and, you know, made mainly in my kitchen and my apartment. Anyway, so this was my first foray into what has hopefully gotten a little bit bigger, a little bit more expansive since then. And, you know, bringing it back to synesthesia for a moment, it just seemed like, even if I hadn't already been making movies, this just seemed like such an obvious candidate of something to put on screen, because it's not necessarily a visual phenomenon, but there's such a high chance that it might be, right? Or that it might be auditory. And visual and auditory, well, those two things are cinema. That's what you have. So
yeah,
it made so much sense to make a film about this.
Yeah, no, that was my next question, was how did the magnetosphere come into existence? But you've got there ahead of me. Was it something that, you know, I was going to ask as well, was it inspired by your own experiences? But you, of course, you didn't realize you had those experiences until you started researching. So how did magnetosphere sort of, was it just you heard about synesthesia, you read about it or something? And
I read about it a lot. I mean, before I was purposefully reading about it, I think I had just heard about it on a radio program or something like that. I think it was, you know, years ago, I was a teenager, I heard about it on the radio in the car. I think it just stayed in the back of my mind because it seemed so interesting, but I wasn't aware of any personal connection with it at all that I can recall. It wasn't until, you know, years later, I always sort of evoke this as the moment that things turned around toward making this particular movie. I saw a beautiful movie, independent film called Confetti, by a director named Anne, who had written a story about a girl with dyslexia. And there's a lot more to it than that. But what fascinated me about this was the way that the girl's dyslexia was depicted in camera, the shots, the visual effects, the ways that we would suddenly go inside her mind and see how she was looking at Chinese characters and they would flip around, or in some way they would distort. And it was very subtle, as I recall. I haven't seen the movie since, but I remember being very struck by like how neurodivergence was being depicted on camera. And I said to myself, oh, you know, I would love for my next film to do something about a child with an extraordinary either ability or a difference, at least, an extraordinary difference or ability of some kind. And through different conversations with different friends and so forth, I sort of remembered all of a sudden about synesthesia. It was like, oh yeah, what was that thing where you could like hear colors? And I came back to that, and that was when it just seemed like, you know, that was what tripped all the switches, because it just seemed like such an obvious thing to try and put on screen. I was amazed that it hadn't been done more. And I suspect the reason it hasn't been done more is because so many of us who maybe even make films and stuff like that don't realize we have it. So we're not busy depicting it because, you know, unless it's by accident, we're not busy depicting something that we're not even aware is happening, because it's just like, it's part of our own mental landscape, right? And it's just there, it's in the background.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. And I suppose neurodiversity is, I don't know, it's been in the background a lot anyway. And
yeah,
it wasn't really even discussed 20, 30 years ago. So
no,
I suppose the movie industry's been doing it by proxy or by accident. Yeah. You know, if you think of those, a lot of the Marvel characters or the X-Men or the, I don't know, the Will Ferrell or Jim Carrey films, there's a lot of neurodiversity or neurodivergence in a lot of those behaviours that are not necessarily portrayed in the right way, in my opinion. You know, it's just...
No, not always, but it does poke out. It pokes its nose out. I think I've said that earlier. But, you know, what it's showing us is that the people behind movies are so often neurodivergent themselves.
Yeah, yeah. They're naturally creative and want to push boundaries and do something new. I mean, I have to say the visual language of the film is stunning. And I know many of our listeners... I know many of our listeners will appreciate how sensitively it handles neurodivergence. What are your hopes for Magnetosphere? What do you want audiences, neurodivergent or otherwise, to take away from it?
You know, I hope that people keep seeing it in greater and greater numbers and keep realizing how much about our own perception we don't know, because that's kind of the number one thing I've seen happen from it. It sounds a little vague the way I just said it, but the way this happens is that we'll show it like at a live screening of some sort, or I don't know, and somebody will come up afterwards, or somebody will email me maybe and say, I didn't know I had this, or I didn't know this was a thing, but it turns out I taste colors, or it turns out I have mirror touch synesthesia, which is a kind of synesthesia where you feel what other people are feeling, which sounds like dreadful to me, but you know, people experience it. Or what's the other one? Ticker tape synesthesia, where you see all the words that you're saying like tick across the screen in front of you as you say them. People have discovered that they have synesthesia, or that loved ones of theirs have synesthesia, by seeing this film. And even if you don't have synesthesia, and not everybody does, and why would they? It's not necessarily so adaptive. But my hope is that this opens people's minds up to the notion that no two people anywhere see just about anything the same way, and that probably everybody sees the world entirely differently, and that we could all do so much good by just being able to stand in other people's shoes even for a second.
Oh, beautifully put. I mean, that harks back to ancient Greece and Socrates, Aristotle and Plato, you know, and that time with the... one of the things, I always take a Socratic approach to life. I had a very poor education, all the opportunities for an education, but didn't take it until I left school early without any qualifications. So I was always behind. I always felt behind. So it was natural for me to take a Socratic approach, which is Socrates was an advocate of the philosophy that you don't see the world the same way as anybody else, and therefore everything you understand is slightly wrong or different, and therefore we don't know anything. So the only wise person is somebody who can stand there and say, I know nothing, I'm open-minded to this. So that's wonderful. But one thing in the... Did you have anything else you wanted to say on that, by the way? I'm going off on a tangent.
Oh, no, tangents are good.
Good. Okay, yeah, there was one thing in the film that I thought was wonderful. Well, there's lots of things in the film I thought was wonderful, but the one thing that really popped out, and I got kind of... It was one of my emotional moments in the film, and it was when Maggie was clearly aware that she was different and she was struggling with her peers, and it was affecting school life, and things were getting very confusing for her and disturbing and frustrating, and which many listeners will probably connect with, resonate with. But the way the diagnosis came about is beautiful. I won't talk too much about it because I don't want to ruin it for anybody who's going to watch it. But the moment when she realizes she's different, and the teacher realizes she's different, and then she goes through and she gets a diagnosis, it's a wonder. You get that whole journey in there, and I can't think of a film where you get a neurodivergent assessment or diagnosis. Can you correct me on that one? Is there anything?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there must be. I'm sure, especially nowadays, that must be more and more. I mean, especially with autism, and especially with things that are talked about more and understood to have a greater depth and breadth than just, you know, one narrow, like Rain Man type caricature or something like that. But the truth is, I don't know. I know that, you know, in this particular movie, I think you needed to have the quote unquote diagnosis in order for her to know that there was an actual, I don't want to say tangible, but that there was an actual speakable thing that was different about her, rather than just, oh, I'm weird, then this is how I am. But I think it's also okay in some cases not to have a name for what's different, and just to be able to accept, oh, okay, I work differently than other people. You know, my operating system is different. I operate differently than other people, and that's okay. I think in this story, you needed it wrapped up. It's a short film. You know, it's not a short film. It's a short feature film.
I know what you mean. It's
a story.
Yeah, no, it's, well, that's better for me. I love punchy stuff like that. You know, I got into flash fiction years ago because I struggle with reading, so not novels or anything like that. I really struggle with it, whereas flash fiction, you can normally get through that, so it appeals to me. Do you have any plans to explore other neurodivergent traits in your future work?
I don't doubt that it will happen, but at the moment I'm on a sort of indefinite sabbatical, so it would be hard to expand on that. That being said, when I get back to work, I think it will be unavoidable just because it tends to, my previous, best I can speak to here actually, is my previous film to Magnetosphere, which was a very small feature film called Goodbye Petrushka, which came out in 2022. And at some point I started receiving, you know, the film was not widely seen because, again, it's an independent film and the only way that they're ever seen is by word of mouth. They are independent, meaning they have no studio, meaning they have no marketing force behind them. The way they're seen is by people hearing about them on podcasts and on websites and on reviews and on, you know, mentions on Reddit and God knows what, you know, it's like this. It's like what we're doing right now. But with that movie, eventually one day I started getting the odd message saying, oh my God, finally, a movie about a 20-something autistic girl like me. And I sort of just sat there because I was like, this character was not ever for a moment intended as autistic. Not even, did not occur to me. Doesn't mean it's not true. I think it is. But, you know, it was unintentional. And that just shows me how much the neurodiversity is going to seep into my work, no matter what I do or don't do. It's not something I'm going to try to hide.
No, you mustn't. No, definitely not.
And that one was really out of nowhere. I was not expecting to hear. And then, you know, how much I've heard a lot now that film has resonated with autistic people. And, you know, when I look at it through that lens, which again, I didn't intend, I look at it and I think, oh yeah, no, it's not even a stretch to try to see it. It is right there.
Yeah, well, it is, and I think you get this in creativity. You know, genius seeps through, and as part of that genius is all the, I don't know, the chaos of the personality of the writer and what they're trying to get out, and why do you want to talk about? When you think about it this way, where did it come from? Why did you want to talk about a little girl with a difference? You know, just because you were a little girl with a difference once upon a time.
I had all sorts of differences. I still do. But, I think it was more, honestly, I think with this film, it was more wanting to set myself that visual and auditory challenge of, could I bring synesthesia to the screen? And if so, could I do it in a way that resonated with people that actually had it so that it didn't seem fake or made up or like, let's just put a lot of sparkles on something and call it synesthesia? Because, of course, that was a worry. Were people going to see it as just like, oh, here, I'm totally neurotypical and I have no idea what synesthesia is and I've never even talked to anybody, but I'll just give it a bunch of pink stuff and call it synesthesia. I was concerned about that, but fortunately this hasn't come up.
No, you honestly, I mean, I was going to ask about the color in the film and the sound. And is that, has anybody with synesthesia seen the movie and thought that is exactly how it is for me in terms of color, because the colors are beautiful. I love the colors anyway.
Thank you so much. I don't know if anybody has said it's exactly like that for me, but what they have said, and which I've found just as heartening, is this evokes what I have. This reminds me of something I have. Or this, for instance, I don't think it's any spoiler to say that Maggie sees in the movie colorful auras around people. And in the movie, just for ease of depiction, it seemed to make sense this way. They're depicted as sort of like a rim, like a ring around somebody, like a ring around their shape, kind of. And when one person recently saw this who experienced the same thing, evidently that's a common one, auras around people. This person said, oh, this was so cool. I love that she experiences them as different colors. I do too, but mine are like the person is filled in with this color. Like they're, you can still see them, but like superimposed on top of and around their body features are zigzags of purple or whatever.
It's quite a technical question, really, but so don't worry if you can't answer this, and it's a little speculative as well. When I was watching the film and the colors popped up and whatnot, what struck me about it, I don't have synesthesia, but my nervous system picks up on people's emotions and I can instantly feel what they're feeling. I'll try and interpret what they're feeling, you know, right or wrong. And it feels like an energy exchange. or, and I did wonder if the light and the colors or the sounds, they're all forms of energy as well. Could it be like the human nervous system is just vibrating and people with synesthesia are seeing, because obviously, how is it there? What percentage of color and light and sound can senses attune to? It's very small.
It's small. I don't know.
Yeah, it's small, isn't it? We miss, like, it's like a huge, like 80-90% or more of what is in existence we can't perceive. So I wonder if it's a the hypersensitivity thing, which is really common in neurodivergence.
I'm certain of it.
Yeah, so I do wonder if the color that people see is real, rather than, you know, it's just, because obviously they're interpreting it through the senses, and multiple senses can be interpreting and giving their feedback.
Well, there's actually more there that they're actually seeing. They're just able to, well, like how dogs are able to hear higher pitches than humans.
Yes, yeah, exactly. What a fascinating trait. It really is.
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it.
I wonder, have you managed to, out of the, was it 70 or 60, 70 people you spoke to with synesthesia, did any of those guys, were they adults and were they coping okay with it? Did they find it difficult or off-putting, or did they have trouble in relationships because people found it strange or anything?
There was a whole spectrum of reaction and harshness as opposed to gentleness. Some people experienced it in ways that were very overwhelming. And, you know, there's a scene in the movie where Maggie gets sick from the synesthesia. And that's actually, like every single thing that she experiences in the movie, it's based on the experience of a real person with synesthesia. I never made anything up entirely. I might modify or massage something here and there to say, okay, well, you know, can't exactly depict exactly what was described, so we're gonna, you know, change this or make this artistic interpretation or embellishment, but it is all pretty much from life, just not from my life. I heard from some people who, you know, experienced it in ways that interfered with their daily lives, like bad migraines from sound, from color, from other stimuli. I heard from people who found it to be a really pleasurable thing. That was really all across the spectrum.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can imagine, like, I think every single neurodivergent person suffers with burnout or overwhelm or overstimulation. And I think for me, it's a sensory thing. It's too much noise, too much movement, too much motion, too many smells, too many things going on. It's all coming in. I'm trying to interpret it. My nervous system's trying to interpret it all at the same time. And it is massively overwhelming. And I do wonder, people with synesthesia, could it be even more tiring for them to interpret so many more, all these senses coming in, all this information coming into their nervous system through the eyes, ears, nose, and all the senses? I wonder if all that information and all that different interpretation and then the nervous system banging out information for the prefrontal cortex, did you hear that anybody that was completely exhausted all the time? Because I know I suffer with burnout a lot.
It was common. Yes, most definitely. That came up again and again. And it comes up also because synesthesia, it's rarely just synesthesia. I mean, I think sometimes it is, but also it so often co-occurs with like autism. I think that's number one. People can correct me. Yep. ADHD, certainly ADHD, autism, things like dyslexia, other neurodivergences that are escaping me right now. But it's rarely just one thing. It's like you've got these 100 apps open or tabs open on your browser or channels on your television all the time. You can't turn any of them off. So of course you're going to be burnt out.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Nicola, will Magnetosphere, I know it's available in the States. Is it going to be available in the UK or the rest of the world anytime soon?
Yes. So right now it's actually available all throughout North America. So Canada, the States, Mexico all have access to it on Prime Video, on Apple TV, and on about 9 other platforms, which I tend to forget. But if you were to Google Magnetosphere movie, you would immediately find where. In terms of it showing up in the UK and the rest of the world, there have been so many requests, particularly from the UK at this point. And our distributor, which is Freestyle Digital Media, they handle the windows of release in different countries. And unfortunately, I just don't know when those are going to be, but I know that the plan is ultimately for it to be available all around the world. And I know that the UK has been a very popular country to hear from in terms of requests for it.
Yeah, that's great news. I'll make sure that the link to the movie for anybody in North America is on the show notes. And yeah, I know myself and my kids will watch it as soon as it comes out. We'll have to watch it again. And as for the future, Nicola, I implore you to write more neurodivergence into movies. You know, happy to brainstorm characters with you at some point. Thank you, Nicola, so much for joining me today. Your work, honestly, it's a gift to the neurodivergent community and Magnetosphere. It's a film that I felt seen, and my kids too. So I can't talk for everybody, but I can for us. For anyone listening, yeah, I'll pop the link to the film and Nicola's work into the show notes. So if you can, go watch it, share it, and let yourself be pulled into a world where the senses overlap and the colours speak. Nicola, thanks a million.
Thank you so much, George. I appreciate it.
Okay,
I'm so glad the film resonated with you as it did.
No, thank you. You did all the hard work. I just sat there.
You know, it means nothing until people see it. It literally just does not mean anything until it has an audience that it connects with.
Thank you for making the film. Then please take every compliment that you can get for it, because you deserve
it.
Thank you. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you in the next episode.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.